L. Bryant, who sits on the second in the Second Circuit as district judge, a George W. Bush appointee, has just overturned the hateful, noxious, bigoted, prejudicial Defense of Marriage Act. Among other things, she said that no, this is a quote, no conceivable rational basis exists for the Defense of Marriage Act. And you know what? She's correct. She said that the Defense of Marriage Act violates the equal protection principles incorporated in the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution. The case was brought by folks, same-sex couples living in Connecticut, Vermont, and New Hampshire. They said, rightfully, that they had been denied access to services and programs available to other married couples. Now, you, the taxpayer, have paid for the right-wing defense of the Defense of Marriage Act. You did that thanks to House Speaker John Boehner, who funneled a bunch of taxpayer dollars to a nasty little group called the Bipartisan Legal Advisory Group, otherwise known as BLAG. Apparently, Judge Bryant didn't think much of BLAG. She wrote in her opinion, "The fact that the concept of homosexuality as a distinct category or class wasn't fully recognized until the late 19th century is not indicative." Oh, listen to the reasoning. This is what reasoning sounds like. The fact that the concept of homosexuality as a distinct category or class wasn't fully recognized until the late 19th century is not indicative of an absence of a long history of discrimination in light of the long-standing proscriptions on homosexual conduct, conduct that is central, if not tantamount, in some sense, to identity. Moreover, the pervasiveness of the closet in which homosexuals purposefully hid their sexualities could very well explain why it was only in the late 19th century that conceptions of homosexual identity emerged as gay Americans moved into cities and began tentatively stepping out of the closet. A little bit later, she continues, "In sum, the evidence in the record detailing the long history of anti-gay discrimination which evolved from conduct-based proscriptions to status or identity-based proscriptions perpetrated by federal, state, and local governments, as well as private parties, amply demonstrates that homosexuals have suffered a long history of invidious discrimination. Moreover, this conclusion is consistent with the majority of cases which have meaningfully considered the question and likewise held that homosexuals as a class have experienced a long history of discrimination." Whew. That's pretty profound. That's very profound. In this country, it's heartening. It gives one hope that someday the long night of prejudice and bigotry that has bedeviled this country will someday come to an end for everyone. And lo and behold, that line of reasoning came from a George W. Bush appointee by the name of Vanessa Bryant. I don't know if it helped or hurt, or perhaps neither, that she is a person of color. But if it matters, she is. If it doesn't, she is. And her name will go down in history on the side of those who spoke for the rights of the downtrodden, the rights of the overrun, the rights of the bedeviled, the rights of the tormented and the tortured. Her name will go down in history as being someone who refused to remain silent in the face of manifest evil. As I said, though, at a couple of minutes ago, it's about 13 past the hour. As I said a couple of minutes ago, though, this is a tale of two judges. Our other judge is also a George W. Bush appointee. Judge Reggie Walton has sat since 2001 on the federal bench as a district judge in the District of Columbia. He has a most interesting history. Judge Walton averted a life of in his own misery rising above gang violence and turning instead toward academics, winning a football scholarship, getting a Bachelor of Arts degree from West Virginia State College. This state's traditionally and historically black college. And today, Reggie Walton stuck a knife in his home state's heart. For you see, the National Mining Association and the thugs of the coal industry took the EPA to court, the Environmental Protection Agency to court, when the EPA promulgated water quality standards that dealt with conductivity of streams and the way that mountaintop removal operations affected the conductivity of those streams, and conductivity in turn speaks to the ability of life to have anything to do with those streams. Last year, 2011, the EPA issued what they called a final guidance. Not even a law, not even a full-on regulation, just a guidance. Just a little pretty please to the murderous, thuggish industry that holds a death grip over this state. The guidance merely asked the states involved in mining to consider conductivity levels of stream water when they issued mining permits. Four lawsuits were filed, the National Mining Association having filed one of them. And today, Judge Reggie Walton, a West Virginian, Judge Reggie Walton issued a ruling overturning those conductivity guidances, those little pretty pleases in regard to the pollution and killing of streams in Appalachia by companies that care far more about profits than they do about what they do to human health. Judge Reggie Walton overturned the stream guidance. When I saw the news, I was sickened. Simply sickened. Sweet Jesus. And the language of his opinion it made me feel no better. This is what he said. Well, okay, I'm looking for it. Here it is. Here's an excerpt. The court is not unappreciative of the viable interests asserted by all parties to this litigation. How best to strike a balance between, on the one hand, the need to preserve the verdant landscapes and natural resources of Appalachia, and, on the other hand, the economic role that coal mining plays in the region is not, however, a question for the court to decide. In this litigation, the sole inquiry for the court is the legality of the final guidance, and for the reasons set forth above, that inquiry yields the conclusion that the EPA has overstepped its statutory authority under the Clean Water Act and the Surface Mine Control and Reclamation Act, and infringed on the authority afforded state regulators by those statutes. It's a very fancy legalistic way of saying, screw you, hillbillies. But I have a question for Judge Walton. And it goes rather to the heart of the American legal and jurisprudential system. If a court has not the authority to protect defenseless human beings, who will? If the Environmental Protection Agency, protecting the environment, hasn't the authority to do its job, who does? I wonder about Judge Walton. Having just spent a week in Washington, D.C., and run around town a bit, I have a little bit of a sense for what life is like there. Truly, as our friend Jim has noted, it can have the feeling of a forbidden city. You spend enough time in Washington, D.C., and you can start thinking that it really is pretty much the be-all and end-all of America. But it was only a 6-hour drive. Ferg and I got in the car and drove 6 hours, and it was only 6 hours to get from a place where buildings are carved out of gigantic blocks of marble, where monuments dot practically every corner, where beauty abounds, where the very air itself is suffused with the idea of government. It took only 6 hours to get from Washington, D.C. to one of the most tormented, tortured places in all the United States. Reggie Walton, with all of his bullshit babbling about verdant landscapes, says that he has nothing to do with verdant landscapes. He's only trying to decide whether or not the EPA had authority or not. And what he ruled is that the Environmental Protection Agency lacks the authority to protect the environment. Man, that is some catch, that catch 22. It's the best there is. Verdant landscapes, my old Aunt Matilda's left hind foot. This is a human rights crisis. This is a human rights struggle. This is an existential... Oh, I don't want to say battle. I don't want to say war. This is an existential... life. Life-changing intersection between the relentless drive for profit and the desperate drive for basic survival. The tale of two judges. Tale of two judges. And Reggie Walton said, "Die, hillbillies! Die! Die quickly, hillbillies! Die quickly. For this court will not support the Environmental Protection Agency's attempt, weak though it was, this court will not protect the Environmental Protection Agency's attempt to protect you." Because when the Environmental Protection Agency moves to protect the environment, ultimately it is moving to protect the ability of humans to live in it. Jim noting regarding D.C. as the Forbidden City, he said, "As a former resident of D.C., as President Truman said, if you want a friend there, get a dog." And Jim says, "Or in my case, a cat." Well, babies presently growing in the womb in West Virginia and eastern Kentucky and southwestern Virginia and northeastern Tennessee, they have no friend in Judge Reggie Walton. And yet he's a George W. Bush appointee. I bet you he's so pro-life. Goodness me. Goodness gracious me. I bet you he just loves him some little fetuses. But yeah, and responding to Judge Walton's ruling, the National Mining Association, whose lawyers, Crowell Mooring, you might recall, said that birth defects happen disproportionately in Appalachia because hillbillies can't quite help having sex with each other. The National Mining Association said, "Today's decision has truly given coal miners and coal mining communities their day in court and has affirmed NMA's long-standing belief that EPA overreached its authority in its virtual memorandum on eastern coal mining permits and denied those operations the protections provided for under the law." That's from Hal Quinn, who doesn't give a rat's ass about dead hillbillies, the 3,975 excess dead hillbillies that happen every year for the sake of his paycheck. I've got the story in front of me from Tim Schoenberg in Bloomberg. He writes, the ruling sets aside the Obama administration policy issued July 2011 that the agency said was aimed at protecting stream water from the hazards of mountaintop removal coal mining in Appalachia. The policy was established to ensure consistent and timely review of surface coal mining permits under the Clean Water Act and other statutes. The mountaintop removal technique produces millions of tons of crushed shale and sandstone that is dumped in valleys and streams. Rainwater flowing through the debris carries dissolved metals into the water, a potentially harmful mix for humans and wildlife. Hey, Grandpa, what's for supper? Yum, yum, under tooled leather. Man, that's a bitter pill to swallow. So what's the upshot? The upshot is we have to sit around and wait and see if the Sierra Club and the EPA and the rest of the parties to the lawsuit will actually appeal to the D.C. Circuit. And if they do appeal to the D.C. Circuit, then we have to wait and find out if enough members of the D.C. Circuit actually care about poisoned hillbillies to strike down this obnoxious ruling. My state, you see, West Virginia, also sued the EPA. Our state, and the Commonwealth of Kentucky sued as well. The states sued the EPA, begging for the right to poison their own constituents. Yeah, Hal Quinn, maybe your coal companies got their day in court, but the poisoned hillbillies damned sure didn't. It's a 34-page opinion. I am not going to even begin to read it to you. It is depressing. It is dismaying. And it feels more than a little bit, more than a little bit, like a death sentence. And to have it handed down on us by one of our own. Jesus. So what does that do? It means that our only choice is to double down on our own efforts to work harder. Right before Judy Bonds passed away, she said, fight harder. Fight harder. And that's all we can do. Because now it is apparent that the struggle is not only against the coal companies, but against their little pet judges. Verdant landscape. Really? Verdant landscape? But not a word about poisoned babies. Not a word about the children who tonight will bathe in that filth. Not a word. Not a word about the human rights of innocents who receive no benefit from the coal company, who don't have a job. from the coal company, who merely try to live in peaceful, quiet enjoyment of their own property. While coal companies run riot in this state. Oh, no, Kevin, no, don't forget to mention your state's Democratic governor. Earl Ray? Earl Ray was the one who ordered the lawsuit filed against the EPA and against the continued existence of that was a lawsuit filed against 3,975 nameless hillbillies who will die this year and 3,975 who will die next year. Jesus! It works out to about 11 hillbillies a day. Every day in this state, about 11 hillbillies die, so that 11 people can have a job for another year on another mountaintop removal site. That is some kind of banality of evil. I had a long conversation Sunday evening, an excellent conversation Sunday evening, on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. You can get the podcast now. It is awesome. I mean, I'm not saying my performance or anything like that, but if you follow on Twitter, The Angry Indian, you'll find his link. We had long conversations about the nexus between poisoning people and ideas of environmental and social justice. And I'm going to try not to let Judge Reggie Walton ruin the rest of Titanic Tuesday. Although I must admit, he did a damn fine job. It's tough to get that on your first day back. But I guess I shouldn't react this way. It's just another day in the colony. It's just another day being something not quite American. Something not fully, someone who's not fully a member of this country. You know, we Appalachian people, in West Virginia in particular, have a tendency to give a higher per capita ratio of lives to this country's military than any other state in the Union. We die for America real good. But a federal judge can't even exercise his power so that we can go on raising children who can in turn go on and sacrifice their lives and their bodies for this country. A country that holds them in manifest disdain. I ain't gonna cry. Crying does no good. Don't know that shouting does much either. But God, when does it end? When do we stop being the sacrificial victims of the murderous rapacious, avaricious profiteers in boardrooms in New York and Richmond and Pittsburgh and St. Louis and London and Edinburgh and Amsterdam and Paris and Frankfurt and Zurich. When? Or do we simply never get any relief? Is this just our lot in life for having had the misfortune of being the great-great-great-grandsons and granddaughters of people who pushed into these mountains seeking, if you can believe it, freedom? Is that just the price we pay? I don't know. And all we can hope, like I said, is that a judge more humane, a judge more decent, a judge who cares more about human life than Judge Reggie Walton will see this case and understand it for what it is, beyond some twisted right-wing interpretation of judicial interpretation. I imagine you probably can't hear it now, but the thunder is rolling outside the studio. I can only hope that the power stays on. Because there's a lot of stuff to go into this evening. A lot. On this Titanic Tuesday. Let's get this one out of the way real quick, will you? Can we? You know Steve King? Steve King from Iowa Way? Steve King, who is a strident and vocal claimant that he follows the teachings of Yeshua, the brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer. You know, Jesus. No, this isn't Prayer Meeting Wednesday. Jesus, who as a child is apocryphally said to have brought little animals back to life in that moment when he realized the compassionate requirements of his Godhead, you know, if you buy all that. You know what was done to Michael Vick over dogfighting? And the national outrage. Well, Steve King does come from Iowa, and there's some pretty brutal things done to animals there, too. Just in the, you know, cruelty. It's what's for dinner. Contained animal feed operations, CAFO lots, that kind of thing. Steroids, hormones, cattle standing up to whatever passed for knees on a cow in their own feces. Oh, dear. I'm doing it during dinner time again. Sorry. I always think of Scott out there fixing dinner. Sorry. Like I've said before, the meat industry is doing working overtime trying to turn me into a vegetarian. They haven't succeeded yet, but that doesn't mean they're not trying. Well, it turns out that Steve King had a tele town hall. I don't know if that's like Teletubbies or not. Tinky Kinky. I had a teletown hall last week. And he got a question. Well, the fact of the matter is, I'm going to play it for you. Because reading the quote just won't get it.
When the legislation that passed in the Farm Bill that says that it's a federal crime to watch animals fight or to induce someone else to watch an animal fight, but it's not a federal crime to induce somebody to watch people fighting, there's something wrong with the priorities of people that think like that. There's something wrong with Wayne Pacelli and the Humane Society of the United States way of thinking like that.
You got that? Steve King thinks that because there's ultimate fighting and boxing, that the pitting two animals against each other, whether it be dogs or roosters, is the same thing. And remember, this is a friend of Jesus. He thinks there's a problem in having a federal ban on dog fighting. Well, hell's bells, Steve. Let's bring back bear baiting while we're at it. He's actually introduced legislation that would take the starch out of local efforts to stop dog fighting. Here we go. This guy wants to legalize dog fighting and cock fighting and, hell, I don't know, iguana racing? This man has even opposed legislation that would make it illegal to bring a child to a dog fight. Once you get beyond the economic necessities argument, and all, you know, a human being does get a choice in whether to step into the ring. After Parkinson's had set in, nobody said to Muhammad Ali, "Nah, you got to get back out there. You do get to retire." Although there are open questions as to the quality of that retirement. Smokin' Joe Frazier didn't have to fight all the way to the end of his life. George Foreman got to get out of the ring and go out and hustle grills. A dog, a rooster, what have you, a bear, does not have that right nor that luxury. I've always found the idea... Who? What? God, Jesus, I can't get my mind around it. It's too much. But, you know, that's just another day in the Republican Party. That's just another radical reactionary position offered up by the party of God. Kind of adds a little bit of validity to the claim of one member of the Republican Party. Dude, stay off small aircraft. Anybody know who Congressman Richard Hanna is? He's a Republican from New York. He got really sick of watching the filthy, sleazy character assassination of Huma Abedin, you know, Secretary of State Clinton's deputy, her aide. And a story appeared in the Syracuse Post-Standard. And these are the rather stunning words of Representative Richard Hanna. He said, "I have to say that I'm frustrated by how much we, I mean the Republican Party, are willing to give deferential treatment to our extremes in this moment in history. We render ourselves incapable of governing when all we do is take severe sides. If all people do is go down there and join a team, and the team is invested in winning, and you have something that looks very similar to the shirts and the skins, there's not a lot of value there. I'd say that the friends I have in the Democratic Party I find much more congenial. A little less anger. Representative Hanna, stay off small aircraft. John Boehner will not tolerate that. Eric Cantor will not tolerate that. He will be lucky if he is sitting on the toilet brush selection committee if the Republicans remain in control of the House. But Representative Hanna was driven to say what he said is precisely because of the Michelle 1L Bachmans of the world and the banning dog fighting takes away our freedom positions of Steve King. Remember, it was Steve King who said, you know, those homosexuals would be all right if they just shut up and quit telling. They're all homosexuals. Why can't we go back to like the 1950s when they put in the closet where they belong? Praise Jesus. It's wrong, he said, to rate animals above human beings. Is it rating animals above human beings to suggest that human beings pitting animals against each other simply to watch the brute bloodshed of them? Is putting animals... What? Yeah, Dr. John, good question, and I think you're right. This is dominionist dog whistling, right? We were given dominion over animals so we can treat them however we want to. Am I reading it right? Is that his scheme, or is he just a sick bastard? John, why do we have to disagree? He can be a dominionist and a sick bastard. See? We can find common ground. But yeah, I mean, I'm kidding. No, he's a sick dominionist bastard. Because dominionists are sick. Dangerously so. And yes, this is, no pun intended, I'm sure, dog whistling.
Putting animals above the humans violates the covenant that God made with man when he was kicking them out of the Garden of Eden or some such shit as that.
See how it works? This is the Republican Party. This is what you get. And again, as I have said so often, this is the very heart and soul of why I, again, who elects Steve King? Wouldn't it be nice to have the structure to just have people go door to door with a picture of a dogfight animal? You okay with this? Did you vote for Steve King? Because he likes this. He thinks it's okay. He thinks it's a matter of freedom to let people go and see this kind of filthy garbage. You okay with that? Just asking. Right? Like I said, it's badly puzzling. And that's where we find ourselves at the end of this filibobster on this Titanic Tuesday. The end of July. The merciful, longed for end of July. We're very close to just finishing out with our nose above the waterline. Our buddy Sal has offered a Titanic Tuesday challenge to get us out and get us started on the right foot. He's got $100. If 10 of you will match it with $10 of your own, it'll make $200. Two at 50, 20 at 5. If we come up with 100, Sal will match the other. And it is assuredly needed. PayPal button is at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. Thank you for all you do to keep all of this going. We'll take a little break. It's Tuesday, so therefore the Green News Report with Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen is on the way. I love Tuesdays and Thursdays. Lines are open. You know the number, right? 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, Head On. On your nickel, 304-658-3333. Email's real easy. It comes into Bob Kincaid, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D, at gmail.com. And you are welcome to jump into the conversation. It is, after all, conversation radio, not filibobster radio. I wonder how Steve King would feel if maybe aliens from another planet that were about 19 feet tall landed and dropped him in a ring and told him to fight to the death with, oh, I don't know, Eric Cantor. And all the 19-foot-tall aliens sat around placing bets on the two and talked about how they needed their freedom to watch the humans fight. Of course, that's probably a BS argument on my part, because we're humans and we like to. But people like Steve King like to have somebody else do the fighting for him. Just a thought. We'll be back. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Down in the high. Thinking ahead means preparing for the future. The future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's Tuesday, July 31, 2012.
35 to 40% of the crop normally goes to ethanol.
So, am I going to have to fight my Audi for lunch?
It's food versus fuel in the fight over corn ethanol as the nation's record drought continues.
There was overdrawing of power as the demand peaked.
Massive power blackout in India. Germany breaks another world solar record, while we don't. Plus, climate science bombshell.
The shock to me was that the carbon dioxide curve was right on.
A prominent climate skeptic discovers global warming is real and man-made.
Bombshell indeed. All of that and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
90% of Iowa farmers have crop insurance. It's a federal program.
Wait, hold insurance. On, sir. A federal insurance program? That's just Obamacare for our corn.
Curses. Socialism wins again. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Des, the biggest news this week, as far as I'm concerned, is the bombshell, as you described it. Richard Mueller, formerly a climate change skeptic, has a study funded by the Koch brothers, is now pretty much all in on global warming, all in on man-made global warming.
Yes, it's hugely, hugely important, this new study. But first, a few quick headlines. A knockout blackout in India. Reuters reports that chaos has erupted in India again after the second massive failure of their electric grid in 2 days.
There was overdrawing of power as the demand peaked. As a result, 2 to 3 grids tripped simultaneously.
On Monday in northern India, traffic and transportation erupted in chaos as electricity was knocked out to over 300 million people on one of the hottest days of the year.
300 million.
Oh, yes.
And the population of the entire U.S. is...
300 million.
Oh, my Lord.
And it gets worse. Power was barely restored on Tuesday when an even bigger failure occurred. 3 regional electric grids collapsed, leaving an estimated 620 million people without power, more than twice the population of the U.S., and that is said to be the largest blackout in world history. Meanwhile, last week, Germany set a new world record for renewable energy. Germany is now generating 26% of all its energy needs from renewable sources. That's up from 21% last year. Most of that comes from decentralized sources like wind and solar after a decade-long concerted effort to build wind and rooftop solar panels on homes and businesses throughout the country.
Let me just point out, 26% of the entire country, Des, you and I were on a radio show not long ago with a guy by the name of Mark Morano. He's sort of the head of the climate change denier movement, and he called that sort of power boutique energy, the type of energy that we couldn't actually rely on to do any heavy lifting.
And, of course, he's wrong about that. The National Renewable Energy Lab says the U.S. can produce 80% of its energy from renewable sources by 2050.
No wonder they call him Mark Morano.
Here in the U.S., record drought has pushed U.S. ranchers and livestock producers to request that the federal government suspend quotas that divert the nation's corn crop for ethanol production. The record Midwest drought and heat waves have decimated the nation's corn and soybean crops, and that has driven up the price of corn for animal feed for livestock producers.
You've been saying for years that the use of corn in ethanol is really putting our food supply versus our fuel supply at stake.
Yeah, it's cattle versus cars. Finally, that climate science bombshell, calling himself a, quote, converted skeptic in the New York Times, prominent physicist and climate skeptic Dr. Richard Muller of UC Berkeley has released a landmark review of global temperature data. Although his study was funded by the oil billionaires and climate deniers, the Koch brothers, Muller nonetheless corroborates the findings of the global scientific community, finding that, quote, global warming is real, it is on the high end, and humans are almost entirely the cause, as he explains to MSNBC's Rachel Maddow.
The shock to me was that the carbon dioxide curve was right on. At that point, I was very surprised. The curve of global warming simply matches that of carbon dioxide. At that point, my opinion finally formed.
This was an incredible revelation, frankly. This guy was a great skeptic. As you say, he was funded by the Koch brothers, famous deniers, famous skeptics. And, well, I guess we have to thank them for funding Richard Mueller.
The climate change denial industry is now spinning furiously, trying to discredit their former friend. Some even accuse Mueller of actually being a double agent who was only posing as a skeptic for all these years.
Of course. They do. For more on that story and the ones we couldn't get to, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Don't forget, you can download us anytime on iTunes. You can listen to us on your mobile device via Stitcher Radio. And you can follow us 24/7 on the Twitters at Green News Report. Keeping an eye on those double agents here at bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
It's your second hour in the liberal sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
The hour. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn. We will probably have a conversation about a question I was asked in the chat room a little bit earlier because it's rather disturbing. But also, if you run over to Alternet, and by all means, feel free to comment. If you run over to Alternet and look for Jeff Bigger's blog at Speakeasy. Alternet.org/speakeasy/Jeff Biggers. Breaking: besieged coalfield residents denounce court decision against EPA rules on mountaintop removal. You'll have a little more depth about exactly what the Honorable Reggie Walton did to us today. And like I said, do please feel free to comment. You know the number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. Let's go to the phones and, hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Bob.
How are you, Jim? Good to hear from you.
Likewise. I'm very happy that you and your son had a meaningful visit to the nation's capital.
To the Forbidden City?
Yeah, I mean, how long ago did I coin that term?
You know, it was a couple of years at least.
Yeah, that's, you know, when I saw the film The Last Emperor initially, that's exactly what Beijing in the early 19th century reminded me of, the Forbidden City. And that's what Washington is, or it was to me. And I lived there for a number of years and had to work with some of these people, like you tried to deal with some of them. But try being a federal employee who's trying to make things work better.
Right. You don't enter the federal service on a lark.
No, you don't.
Especially in Republican administrations, federal servants, civil servants especially, are used as the whipping posts?
Essentially, effectively. And, you know, every so many years, whether it's 2, 4, and 6, you'll find some idiot up there who thinks that he can balance the budget on the back of the federal workforce.
Right.
And what enemies these federal employees are. When basically, those people who are dedicated to federal service are trying to ameliorate, not exacerbate, existing problems.
You know, I don't want to jinx anything, but I've never run across a nasty federal employee. Most of the time when I've dealt with them, how can I help? What can I do for you? And that's, you know, that doesn't, if you're walking into a museum, or if you're calling Social Security, or the FDA, or the EPA, you know, and yet, you're absolutely right. They're demonized.
They are. You know, I've been demonized and, you know, criticized and, you know, made to look like some type of booger bear, when the real ones who are the demons are the ones we send up there every 2, 4, and 6 years. And they simply enter the confines of the District of Columbia in most cases, not all, in many cases, I'll say many cases, not all, to feed at the trough. You know, Wall Street and K Street.
Yeah.
That's exactly what these people are up there to do. I mean...
Well, like I said while I was gone, Jim, you know, I just stood and looked at the Heritage, because it wasn't very far from where we were, stood there and looked at the Heritage Foundation building and you know, looked at Ferg and I said, do you have any idea the amount of evil that is generated in that building every day? You know, those aren't federal civil servants. Those are people who are on a salary and are paid daily to try to tear our government to pieces.
Well, they're basically sent there and are in the employ of those people who want to hopscotch their way through into drowning the federal government in a bathtub.
Yeah.
And they want to destroy any social contract that was created during the New Deal administration of FDR and other far-seeing leaders who wanted to use the federal government to help people. And that's what they're there to do. You know, it's not amazing to me to see that so little gets done there and that so many adverse decisions have come there. But recently, I mean, well, initially, during the first years of my life there, there was some type of spirit of compromise, but that's gone now. I mean, you've got these people who are on these teams, as you call them, and they've changed politics into an absolute blood sport. And it's not unusual to hear that some idiot up there wants to legalize blood sports between innocent animals and things of that nature. That just makes my blood run cold. It really does.
It is.
A lot of blood flow in my life, let me tell you.
Well, Jim, I can't, it's moments like that that I say, you know, is there nothing in this country we can agree on? I mean, Jesus, dogfighting and we can't agree on it?
I don't think people want to agree on anything. They've just become so polarized and so demonized by Radio Rwanda and Fox News and these right wing, what can I call them? I don't know what to call them. I'll just say right wing people who have no real soul.
Well, you know, we've tried for years to define them. We've talked about broken brains, and we've talked about the amygdala and the lizard brain, and soulless, and
Bob, there are some people who are just plain outright mean and mean spirited.
Well, but let's take Steve King just as a for instance, Jim. I carry no brief of animus against the people of Ohio or the people of his district. But when he is returned to Congress year after year, term after term, I mean, does the news not reach Iowa of what a malevolent, hate-filled freak he is? What conclusion are we to draw about that congressional district except to say that a majority of them are as nasty as he is? I'm not yelling at you. This is the frustrating nature of the inquiry.
But in politics today, particularly in Ohio, with electronic voting and all the stuff that we've talked about over the years, a little hush money does a lot of talking. Who knows?
And a little voter suppression, maybe.
Suppression and voter fraud and stuff like that. I mean, it's totally, it's become... What is so frightening to me is people have become so inured to it, they no longer pay any attention to it, and it's accepted as a normal practice. You know, vote now and vote often. Or if you can't do that, find a company like Diebold that will absolutely skew the election in the direction in which they're paid to do. Does that make any sense?
Well, yeah, it does. I'm just stymied. Are you basically painting a picture of a government that is irretrievably broken? Because if government is to be based
effectively
upon the will of the people, and the will of the people is there's no way to manifest it. I think you understand what I'm getting at. I mean, for instance, Steve King represents Sioux City and Council Bluffs, Iowa. I find it hard to believe that, and maybe somebody from Iowa will straighten me up, but I find it difficult to believe that Sioux City and Council Bluffs, Iowa, are as filled with toxic hatred as this man is.
Well, yeah. And, you know, these people who put him back in there every election cycle after every election cycle, in my opinion, are so woodenly stupid or stupidly wooden that...
If you go to Steve King's website like I just did, you get a pop-up ad from him. Obamacare, fact or fiction? Click here to see some reasons why Obamacare must be repealed.
Well, they pulled out all the stops on that, that's for sure. And they don't want to see people have access to decent medical care. And you've got so many powerful lobbyists up there. I mean, the AMA, for example, and other groups that offer these representatives God only knows what to vote their way. I mean, once you get inside the Beltway, you're totally insulated from what the people are supposed to have represented by sending you there. And these guys are up there to try to enrich themselves and to... become millionaires, if possible, or if probable. And they lose sight of why they were there. And the thing about it is, the spirit of public service with these elected representatives has simply died. It's gone away. It's become as extinct
as the dodo.
As some creature from the Cretaceous or the Jurassic period. I mean, like I said in my email to you, when you go to Washington, D.C., if you want a friend,
get a dog.
Because you're not going to find any two-legged ones out there. And you had just have to work in that environment in federal agencies and have to deal with the stuff that comes out of the Capitol building and other, and as well as the Supreme Court, and you know, and if you try to resist it,
you'll be consumed by it.
They'll find some way to get you out. I can guarantee you that. It's really dirty. It's really dirty. I mean, it's the dirtiest stuff I've ever seen in my life. And it's very sad. I mean, I once was very idealistic and devoted my whole career to public service. First as a school teacher, then as a state employee, and then for 20 years as a federal employee. Because I was inspired.
And if you and Jim, if you had it to do over again, would you?
Probably. Yeah, I would. I would. You know, I was inspired by John Kennedy and what he said. To do what you can for your country. And to make it a better place. And to achieve some type of inroad or access road to that shining city on a hill.
Exactly.
That's what I would try to do. And that's if I had my life to live over again, which is, well, you know, I'm at the end of it now. And so looking back over those years, the only thing I could try to do was to try to do it better. And to try to be a little more savvy and circumspect and not so idealistic. Because these people, to them, idealism is extinct as a dodo. It's just what they call some type of practical realpolitik in which you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, and every election cycle will come back and we will post all the shibboleths and slogans and stuff like that to try to fool the voter, and then, of course, just go back to what we were doing before. Self-aggrandizement, self-enrichment, and careerism, that type thing. I mean, look at all these people who work for these lobbyists and stuff like that. All of them have come there to jockey from one position to the other, in which they will get a higher salary, and which they can look forward to some type of retirement of their own at the expense of the people who are dying and who are being denied adequate care and whose atmosphere is being poisoned, water poisoned. You know, they simply seem to think that they're totally immune from the effects of what they've been doing, but one day they're going to pay the price too.
I don't know how they evade it. The only way to evade the price, Jim, is if they're right and we're wrong, and this is all just a bunch of liberal code. That's what the state government of Virginia said, wasn't it? That the word, the phrase "sea level rise" was liberal code. You know, since how can science be liberal code, Jim? That just bedevils me.
Oh, they could make liberal code out of anything, Bob. You know that. You know how they can twist words.
What's for breakfast? Liberal code.
Yeah.
Liberals think they're entitled to breakfast.
Well, you know, if things continue as they are and the climate cycles continue as they are, one day they're going to have to get into Washington, maybe the new Venice of the Middle Atlantic states.
It ain't that high up above the Potomac, is it?
No, it's not. Absolutely. I mean, Washington itself is a seaport city. It certainly is. And, of course, it was built on a swampland and a marsh, and you know how far that is above sea level.
Yeah.
And
Lord, I tell you what, when it gets good and humid there, it feels like you're in a swamp.
Bob, let me tell you something. In the winter, that's when, particularly when you're walking down the street amongst those huge buildings, that's one of the coldest places in the world. And in the summer, when you get off that metro and you're going to wherever you're going, and it's hot like it is, oh God, it is absolute, it's absolutely dreadful. It really is. And you can just, when you walk down the street, just look in the faces of the people whom you meet. I thought New York was tough. But, you know, that's the sociological and climate of New York City. And I think Kennedy once said Washington is a town that has northern manners and southern efficiency.
Yeah.
That's all.
Exactly.
I always remembered that. That was a very good quote.
Yeah.
And that was his reaction to seeing, you know, the inertia there. I mean,
if you just talk to, you know, you run across, it seems like one in three people in Washington, D.C. is some sort of an analyst at the Pentagon. And every last one of them will tell you how frustrated they are at you know, any attempt to get their job done.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you have to, first, as far as entry into federal service, through Office of Personnel Management, or however you're appointed, I mean, that in itself is like a maze that would surprise even Daedalus.
Absolutely.
And then when you get there, the maze becomes one like, well, excuse me, you're looking for the Minotaur to pop out at any moment while you're in that maze.
Yeah, it's tempting. Well, I can tell you that, I mean, it takes, and you probably know better than a lot, it takes a heck of an effort just to get a meeting in a congressional office. I mean, you have to, you know, in the modern era, it's a matter of email. You have to send out an email, and then you just sit and wait and see if they email you back.
Well, unfortunately, when you email these offices, you've got people up there who've just come up there as staffers. And they're there in those offices as staffers to wait till the next better job comes along. And a lot of them are below the age of 25. And I'm talking about the initial contact that you have when you call or email the congressional office. And then you get some type of double entendre response from their boss. Because you don't ever get through their boss, because their boss is always somewhere else.
Well, if you've ever read the book Flatland, you know what, or no, it wasn't Flatland. Maybe it's Flatland, or is it Jonathan Swift? I think it's Jonathan Swift that has the concept of flappers. These people who move the exalted ones' mouths for them.
Exactly. That's exactly.
And the flappers have flappers, and the flappers' flappers have flappers, and that's what I think of.
Yeah, me too. And, you know.
But on the other hand, when you meet with an office that actually gives a damn, it is a completely different experience. I mean, we've had magnificent experiences with, you know, some of the offices we've worked with on the AIC Act, obviously beginning with Representative Kucinich's office and Representative Slaughter's office and Representative Conyers' office. Everybody who has signed on to this bill has been receptive and caring and concerned and genuine. But when you walk into an office where you know they just don't much care, it takes an amount of time that cannot be calculated by present computer science. I mean, it's that fast, and you know.
I do. Certainly do. But I wanted to plug a book tonight, if I may, please.
Certainly.
And that is a book called The Help by Catherine Stockett.
Yeah, the book that the movie was based on?
Yeah, have you seen that movie?
No, I have not.
For God's sakes, go to Amazon, pull it up. You can download it from your Kindle for $9.99, and it is an incredible novel that's based upon actual research that was done by a lady in Mississippi among black women who had to serve in white households.
Yeah, we had a lot of discussions about it when the movie came out.
We did?
On this program, not you and I, but the larger Horn family.
I must not have been there, because when I saw it last night on Showtime, and it's coming back on tonight on Showtime around 8 o'clock, one of the Showtime things, I'm going to record it, because this is definitely a keeper. And it is an incredible book, and it's a very telling about Mississippi Stan and the attitudes of the black people who had to work for their white overlords. And it touched me very deeply. I'm surprised. I guess maybe I wasn't in contact with Horn during the time when you guys discussed it. But it certainly had a very great impact upon me. And, of course, I witnessed a lot of this myself growing up in South Carolina. And, yes, you know, seeing the disparity and the unfairness and the lack of humanity and compassion between those people who serve their white masters.
And, you know, that is the operative phrase. One of the takeaway is that didn't much change after 1865.
Oh, no, Jim Crow and all these other things, and, of course, the attitudes never changed, and, you know.
Of course, you provide me, you open a little door for me here, Jim, a bit of a segue. The question presents itself, how much anything has changed since? I mean, I'm looking at two stories here right now. One, headline, Florida man charged with hate crime says he, quote, only shot a, and that word.
I know.
And it's a story out of Port St. Joe, Florida. And he was angry that he was arrested because he said he only shot up N-word.
Incredible. It's just incredible. I mean,
it's 2012. You have noted that there are some things only the grave can solve. But when does the last one that this hatred has been passed down to finally go away and leave us in peace?
Bob, I don't know if it ever will.
Out of Ohio, Sandra sent this along. Out of Ohio, a man checked into a Motel 6, and when he turned on his TV, a message appeared on his screen, Hello, N-word.
You've got to be kidding.
No, sir.
No, I guess you're not, are you?
I wish I was.
I wish you were, too. I do. I don't know. I just don't understand that, because I've never had that type of insensitivity or hatred as part of the fiber of my being. And I just can't understand it.
And it goes on and on and on. I saw a story, uncorroborated, but disturbing just the same, saying that investigators who had seized George Zimmerman's computer, you know, Trayvon Martin's killer.
Oh, yeah.
Found evidence that just hours before he had killed Trayvon Martin in cold blood, he had been trolling hardcore black gay porn sites.
I'm sorry? He'd been surfing
hardcore black gay porn sites.
Well, I don't know how to react to that.
Well, then you're about to be in the same boat I am.
I mean,
some of the, you see it.
I'm sorry, you know, what is the term, gobsmacked?
That's one of them. Flabbergasted, flummoxed, horrified.
Yeah.
And then, you know, all things being circular, it doubles back to not surprised a damn bit.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Well, I'm not really surprised. I guess, I mean, when all the stuff that's happened in this country in the past 2 weeks, I mean, the shooting in Aurora, Colorado, and all the other things that are going on, and it's just people have become to the point that they're...
Well, you mentioned earlier this notion of both detachment and polarization in this country. There was a comedian, I can't remember his name, and frankly I don't care to mention it, if I did, who in the wake of the Aurora massacre, responded by saying, well, have you seen the movie? About 25 minutes in, I'd be sitting there saying, just shoot me too.
What did he mean by that?
Well, he meant that it was a really bad movie.
Well, I mean, are you surprised to look at the crap that's coming out of Hollywood and to see how violence and the horror that these films invade into the human mind and psyche? People see this stuff and it becomes acceptable.
I mean, honest to Jesus.
I mean, you know, the other night I tried to watch one of those films with Arnold or whatever, and it got to the point that I had to turn the sound down because there was no dialogue. It was gunfire or explosions going off. I mean, it's just incredible to me how... I mean, we talk about Rome in its heyday and the horrors of the Colosseum. Well, I think the horrors of the Colosseum are almost brought to us every day, whether we see it on television or go to the movie to see it. I mean, if there isn't gratuitous violence or some type of sex thing that is, I guess I'm old-fashioned, but nonetheless, it's becoming acceptable. I mean, it is hard for me to understand how people can be so inured to it. Does that make any sense to you?
Yeah, it does. It does. And meanwhile, coming from Benedict in the chat room, Jim, this explanation, it's hierarchy, Bob. As long as the white masters promise the white plebes they can stay on the second rung of the ladder and that people of color will always be held on the first rung, the lower rung, southern yahoos will keep reelecting their white masters no matter what else.
Well, there it is, and there you have it. You know, you've got the upper class, you've got the poor white trash, and of course the poor white trash think they're always above the black people.
Well, it's the one tool that the propertied class has always used to make sure that poor folks don't look around and go, wait a minute, we have something in common here. We're all poor and we're all being oppressed.
Oh yeah, yeah. And if you hang around long with us and vote with us, you might have the chance of becoming one of us.
Yeah, that's... Yeah. Right, that's that Republican mindset that poisons a certain segment of the population today. You know, well, I don't want to see high taxes because I might be rich someday.
Well, there it is.
After I done pulled myself up by my own bootstraps.
Mm-hmm. They have a carrot that's stuck out there in front of their, you know, on a long pole. Say, so, you know, you just keep on running hard enough, fast enough, and maybe you'll get a piece of the pie, too. Or
Carrot, that's right there. Why can't you reach that? You're just not working hard enough.
Yeah, yeah, and we don't care who you have to step on to get to it. That's how we got it.
Man.
That's bad. Look, I've taken enough of your time. By the way, I'm glad you had a pleasant experience at the National Gallery when you and your son had to go.
It was a beautiful time. I could have spent days there, but we had an opportunity. We knew what our schedule was, and so early that day we walked around the National Gallery. And there's a whole lot to be said for seeing Giorgione and Titian and Raphael and the rest of that crowd, you know, actually standing there looking at it.
Exactly. And in my email to you, you know, when you, I used to sit there and watch and look at these portraits and things like that, and I would always think, I just wonder what was in the mind of the subject of the portrait at the time that it was being painted, and what was in the mind of the painter when he was doing the work.
Well, and see, that's one of the deviling, but that's one of the, actually it's delightful, is that because some of the provenance has been lost over the centuries, you wind up seeing titles of, like, Portrait of a Genoese Gentleman, Portrait of a Venetian Youth, Portrait of a Florentine Lady. And you just ask, you know, who were they? Because somebody, especially in the case of the kids, the parents were obviously proud enough of their young'un. You know, he'd probably survived plague and the usual litany of childhood diseases that made it, you know, that made it such that in that era, you didn't even really invest a lot of love into your kid till they got to age 7 or so.
Because you didn't know if you were going to keep them or not.
Right.
Know?
And so, you know, they get to be 13, 14. You know, get Raphael over here. Got to get a portrait. And so, you know, who was he? Who were, you know, the parents were obviously well-to-do because they could afford a portrait. But there was one moment that really blew my mind, and they were portraits by Titian. And one of them was simply Portrait of a Lady. And she was blonde, and she was absolutely beautiful. And it's a huge painting. And hanging right next to it was another portrait that was supposedly of some biblical figure. And, I mean, it didn't take an abacus to figure out that the lady in the portrait to the right was the same as the biblical figure in the portrait to the left.
Well, it's just incredible how, you know, they were with portraiture in those days. You know, they...
But with, in particular, at the risk of putting, well... No, I hope the Horn family is as interested in this kind of stuff as I am. In particular, the colors, Jim, the colors, especially those of Giorgione.
Very vibrant.
More than you can even imagine. I mean, just leaping off the, well, some cases wood, some cases canvas, at you. And then the one, you know, there's only one Leonardo da Vinci painting in the entire Western Hemisphere, and it resides there in that gallery.
Right.
And I found her every bit, of course I've never seen the Mona Lisa, but I found her every bit as engaging and enigmatic as everyone says the Mona Lisa is. And a darn sight prettier.
Exactly. You know, that's the difference between snapshot photography, which captures basically a moment in time, as opposed to a portrait in which there is human feeling, as opposed to mechanical and optometric representation.
Right. I mean, no, there, you know, there's more that goes into portraiture than the simple capturing of the image in a moment.
One would hope so, absolutely, because there's feeling, there's humanity, and in the day and time in which we live, we see a lessening degree of that humanity, a lessening degree of that human spirit.
And you know, it's a big museum.
Oh, it's huge, absolutely.
And at the time that it built, it was the largest structure in the world made entirely of marble.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But we got done with the Italian Renaissance and a little bit more, and I looked at Ferg and said, well, let's go look at some of the sculpture, and then let's get out of here. Because I felt like I was sitting at a banquet, and I was honestly running at that point in time, Jim, on pure sensory overload.
Oh, I'm sure you were.
So I decided that we would save the Dutch Masters and the French Impressionists for later.
Well, I look forward to the time when you get to see these marvelous works of art.
Oh, yeah.
And as I've recommended to you many times, if you can, go to Dumbarton Oaks on R Street for Byzantine art, or go to Hillwood up off Linnean Avenue and see the actual treasures.
Stand by while I write those down just real quick. Dumbarton Oaks.
On R Street, and it's basically a wonderful repository for Byzantine art.
Oh, well, because there was a little bit of Byzantine work there in the front end of the Italian section. And the other, Hillwood?
Hillwood Museum. And it's the home of Marjorie Mayweather Post. And it's an entire day experience. There's a cafeteria there, and you will get to see as many Fabergé eggs as there are in the Kremlin, or without Malcolm Forbes. And you will get to see some marvelous Russian portraiture, as well as, you know, artifacts from the 18th and 19th century. Because, you know, back in those days when her husband was ambassador to Moscow, Russia was in a severe currency crisis. And Abel Harriman was her husband at that time. And he bought this stuff up for a song. And it's a brick Georgian house, and of course there were many people who came to visit Mrs. Post when she was one of the hostesses of Washington, and Winston Churchill, FDR, and people like that. And one of her favorite pastimes was square dancing.
Oh wow, I had no idea.
Oh yeah, it's incredible. She was a smart lady, and she has a daughter that's still around, Ina Merrill, who's a damn good actress. And, of course, Mrs. Post was no fool. And, of course, she was brought into the business very early by her father. Post-hosties and stuff like that. But it's just an incredible collection of Russian art. And I've always been a devotee of that. And I will dare say this. I mean, I've been to the Hermitage in St. Petersburg. And I've been to Hillwood. And I can guarantee you there's a definite link in comparison between those two places.
That's amazing.
It is amazing, actually. I mean, what Stalin was willing to sell and let go because of the currency crunch of the 30s when he was trying to make socialism in one country work. But nonetheless, it's, for example, and I'll get off here, there is a desk in Mrs. Post's bedroom that was the property of Marie Antoinette. And you can see the little compartments into which she placed her secret correspondence. And being the student of history that I am, might not be a very good one.
You know the idea, or you've got an idea of what some of that was?
Yes, sir, I do. Absolutely. And It's just incredible. And when I went into Hillwood for the first time and I saw what I saw, because I had seen a lot of this stuff in books before, and I asked the guy who was giving the tide, the tour, and he said, where did you find out this information? Because there was a portrait of the late Tsarevich, the one who was murdered with his family at Ekaterinburg, which she used to hang in the apartments of his grandmother, Nicholas' mother.
Oh, my heavens.
And to look into that, the sad eyes of that little boy, it was a very moving experience for me.
Couldn't help but be. Just couldn't help.
Absolutely, absolutely. just a boy who was born at the wrong place at the wrong time, and unfortunately, with his father being at the wrong type of job that he never really wanted.
Yep.
On that note, I'm going to leave you to your guest, and I hope that you have good weather. It's not thundering over here.
It's still rattling around here. I guess we drove in underneath it, and I had a little bit of misgivings, Jim, because the last time we drove in with a thunderstorm coming, we wound up without power for 12 days.
Oh boy, that was not a good thing.
Oh, and by the way, I got to because you are a West Virginian, I got to throw this out there for your consideration.
Oh.
I just found out that our junior senator, Joe Manchin, referred to the district court in Washington's ruling today, you know, the one that allows the coal companies to continue poisoning us, as a great day for West Virginia.
That's very touching. I can't tell you where it's very touching because it wouldn't be proper for me to say on the air, but it's very touching.
Yeah. I know exactly what you mean. Jim, thank you very much, and have a great night.
And to you too, sir.
All right, bye now. About 10 minutes before the hour, and we'll go ahead and take our top of the second hour break. I wanted to tell you, Sal kindly put a challenge out on the table. He will match the first 100 that comes in tonight that will mercifully get us out of July. And we are $45 toward that, so $55 more, and Sal's challenge is met, and we pay more bills. The PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com. So thanks very kindly for those of you who have helped so far. Thanks to Sal for the challenge, and thanks to all of you who have kept this going through what has been, through every month, but especially through this one, which seems to have been an especially brutal month. By the way, Dr. John responded in regard to Richard Hanna, the Republican legislator from upstate New York, who said that we render ourselves incapable of governing when all we do is take severe sides. Dr. John says, Richard Hanna fended off a strong Tea Party primary challenge, and his redrawn district is very much in play. It includes lots of people connected with Cornell, Ithaca College, Syracuse, and SUNY Cortland. He's voted for Planned Parenthood funding, among other things. He is considered a moderate. Does anybody live in that district? Can anybody give him a jingle and tell him about H.R. 5959, the AIC Act? I can't think. I mean, it would be nice to see some proof that there is a Republican who actually gives a damn about what happens to people in Appalachia. Maybe it's Representative Hanna. Is there anybody in this listening audience who can reach out to him and tell him about this, the single greatest opportunity we have to stop Appalachia's agony? Is that possible? So we are a little ahead of things, but we'll take our break and come back. It is Titanic Tuesday. Those Titanic plates, they're moving all the time. It's Titanic Tuesday on the horn. This is Conversation Radio. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. And I'm Bob Kincaid.
Russians love their children too. And I say my letter. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. What's a boomer to do? That seems to be the current obsession of Bill Keller, columnist and former executive editor of the New York Times. In his drivel on Monday, he squandered hundreds of words about the baby boom generation, rehashing the old argument over whether it's selfish and self-absorbed, and concluding, hold your breath here, that we are an entitled bunch. Then he used this creaky springboard to go after so-called entitlement programs, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. He bought the bogus conservative argument that these programs are unsustainable, and he falsely argued that cuts in military spending or raising taxes on the rich couldn't possibly fill the funding gap. The question, he said, is not whether entitlements have to be brought under control, but how. Easy for a New York Timesman to say, since his retirement is going to be pretty cozy. Keller goes on to say, we should make a sensible reform of entitlements our generation's cause, as if cutting benefits to the elderly and the poor is somehow something noble. Anyway, doesn't he and his generation have something better to do? If he's looking so desperately for a cause, how about ending poverty here at home, or hunger worldwide, or reversing global warming, or ridding the world of nuclear weapons? Those efforts might be worth a boomer badge, but not Keller's. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
A minute before the hour, so hey, we've got an extra minute to conversationalize between now and the end of the program. It's bonus radio. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn, headonradionetwork.com. You can follow me and The Horn, you can follow The Horn and I separately, not together, over at Twitter. The Horn account is at The Horn. Aren't we clever? And extending the cleverness, my Twitter address is at Bob Kincaid. And when you do that, a lot of times the best way for me to get stuff out there that I'm reading or that others are reading and sending to me is simply to follow that Twitter feed and get it that way. And then anything that I put up also cross-posts over to my utterly loathsome and obnoxious Facebook feed. So you can follow at Bob Kincaid. You can also follow The Horn on Facebook, into the bargain. So, you know, we've got that. And hey, you know, for those of you who enjoyed having someone actually answer the phone before you went on air, that was Agnes, and she's gone now. So you're back to going on hold when you call. Email coming in from our buddy Andy in California. Mr. Bob, have you seen this? When you mentioned Blanche Mansion, it's a great day for West Virginia when we get to poison more West Virginians. When you mentioned Blanche Mansion, it reminded me of this piece in The Hill. Senator Tom Coburn, R., Oklahoma, batshit crazy, and Joe Manchin both have the same view on policy and the deficit. Headline, donation to Manchin is new fodder in feud between Norquist and Senator Coburn. Oh, jeebus. The Grover Norquist gang of thugs is mad at Senator Coburn for giving money to Blanche Mansion, because Blanche Mansion is about as much of a Democrat as Senator Coburn is. I guess they're having a squabble. Andy asks, is there any difference between Senator Mansion and a Republican? Only that he calls himself a Democrat. What a sick state of affairs we find ourselves in, and that's the truth. There's a saying that runs around this state, the only Democrat a Mansion ever voted for is another Mansion. Back in the late 60s, early 70s, they founded an organization called Democrats for Arch Moore, who was a Republican. And in 1996, they founded an organization called Democrats for Underwood and elected a man who was very nearly, a corpse, to be the oldest governor ever of the state of West Virginia, rather than having a progressive female be governor. That's how vindictive that bunch can get. So, yeah. 2.5 minutes past the hour, and we will stop the shilly-shallying and go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's John, temporarily in upstate New York.
How you doing, John?
I'm doing great. How are you? You sound great tonight.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah.
It's nice to be home. I admit I'm a little bit tired and road weary and stuff like that, but you'll learn about that here in a little while yourself.
Yeah, definitely. I'm impressed you made it back into the chair in time. That's got to be a rough drive back, I gather, from what you're saying. It doesn't look like very far, but it must be tough, huh?
Well, it's 72 miles from D.C. to the end of I-66, and then it's a couple of hours down I-81 through Harrisonburg and Stanton to roughly Lexington, Virginia, and then across from Lexington to Beckley, and then from Beckley to here. And it's just, you know, after you've made it a half a million times or so, it gets a little tiresome.
Yeah, probably. I mean, I've been sort of around there. Probably super pretty till you hit the MTR scars, I'd imagine.
It is. My big gripe, I guess, is that I have yet to get on I-81, John, when it wasn't just a day at the races. And yet at the same time, it's a day at the races that's going somewhere between 60 to 70 miles an hour, and the speed limits go up and down based upon Virginia's need to increase traffic ticket revenue. So you're constantly in between a bunch of semis. Or let's see, today's adventure on I-81 was having a guy pulling a trailer with a vehicle on it that was older than I am, and wasn't exactly what you'd qualify as collector's antique status. Yeah, his trailer blew a tire, and it went and he, the trailer, the vehicle, pretty much owned both lanes of the road for about a mile and a half, while the rest of us just sort of sat, you know, rolled along behind him, hoping that, you know, the little worn out old car didn't wind up in our faces.
Oh man! Wow. Well, that sounds like an adventure. Listen, I wanted to ask a couple things. One of them was, do you know anything about this mountaintop removal action that happened this past weekend? I gather it was at the Hobet Mine and the Ramps campaign was involved. Do you know anything about this?
I do, and I want to be very careful what I say, because I don't want to be taken wrong.
I expect it, okay.
There was a time in this state where direct civil disobedience was definitely called for, because we had to bring national attention to what mountaintop removal is.
Yeah.
And we had to bring congressional attention to it. That's largely happened. It used to be, the first two people to get arrested were Bo Webb and Judy Bonds.
Really?
Yeah. One of them is a patron saint of this program, and the other is my nearest colleague in working on this ongoing nightmare. And they knew what they were doing. And before they ever risked arrest, they made sure that they had bail money. And I have never risked arrest myself because, and I hope we can discuss this, I don't believe in it.
Yeah.
I don't believe in enriching a corrupt government with the funds of poor people for the purpose of symbolism.
Yeah.
There was an occasion a few years back where Bo and I and a couple of other folks were in Washington, and they did a sit-in at the EPA. And it was a Friday. It was near Halloween. And toward the end of the day, we had a little hillbilly confab, John. There were a bunch of young people of really good will in there, and there was an organization that was all ready to go and pay their bail and pay their fine, so that it would be catch and release. But it was a Friday, and the cops were good enough to come to us and say, listen, it ain't going to be catch and release because it's Friday and all the magistrates have already gone home. They're going to spend the weekend in jail.
Mm-hmm.
So we went in and told the young people what the reality was, and they were like, "Well, we don't care." And it was heart swelling. It was beautiful. It was a grand moment. But we looked at them and said, "Listen, you don't need to spend the weekend in jail for us. You have made your point today, and you've made it brilliantly, and it's true. There was media coverage. It had all gone out. Sit in at EPA. It was all there." So we said, "You know, listen, come on out. And, you know, go get a nice meal and be really, really proud of the impact that you made today."
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sorry, you were going to say something?
Oh, no, I was, you go on, you're on point here.
This event took place and we've seen people do direct actions and have $100,000 bonds hung on them.
Mm-hmm.
By comparison, as I think I've mentioned in the past, a pro mountaintop removal person came across a nonviolent protest line and punched Judy Bonds in the head, who at the time, she didn't know it, but she had cancer growing in her brain.
Mm-hmm.
That woman was given a $100 fine and court costs and told to go and sin no more, not even jail time. And she certainly wasn't jailed in lieu of bond. The same thing was done with the man who threatened to slit the throats of a man and his 4-year-old son at a 4th of July picnic.
On video, right?
On video.
I saw that, yeah.
Yeah. And then when other civil disobedience began to ramp up a couple of years ago, yeah, we began to see $50,000 and $75,000 and $100,000 bonds, and we realized that protest in West Virginia had become untenable.
Mm-hmm.
And so this action went down, and I don't want to be mistaken. It was bold action. It was brave action. It was heroic action, and I applaud all of it. It takes courage to do this kind of thing, John.
Mm-hmm.
But now you got 20 people sitting in a regional jail waiting for $500,000 in cash money to be raised to get them out.
Yeah.
That's $500,000 that could go a long way towards stopping mountaintop removal, but instead will go into the coffers of Lincoln County, West Virginia, and will remain there until the cases are resolved.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't see that as best practices at this point in time, because, you know, you've got local county sheriffs and city police and people like that who are more than willing to hurt people.
Mm-hmm.
We'd seen it in years past. An internationally recognized, celebrated photojournalist, a pair of them, who had thousands of dollars of camera equipment taken from them by the sheriffs, handed over to employees of Massey Energy, and destroyed. So this is the atmosphere that we operate in here. This is the atmosphere. This is the reality on the ground in Appalachia, John. I don't go around talking. I try not to talk about this in any sort of grandiose terms, but this can be a very frightening place.
Yeah, no doubt. And I was curious to hear your take. That's very, very much sort of what I was thinking, and maybe my inner radical isn't really showing here. But I've been involved in things similar to this, involving the Iraq War and voting rights and that sort of thing. And in every case, it's been like what you've described. You know, it's very clear who is going to be arrested, and everything I've been involved in has had mechanisms set up to deal with bail. And while I think that this is a great, I'm happy people are doing things, my impression is that wasn't set up, and now they've kind of dug themselves into a hole, and I'm sorry to see that. So I was curious about your take, and actually we have a mutual acquaintance who was involved in that. She wasn't arrested, but I'm glad.
And I know who we're talking about, and I admire her very, very much.
So do I.
She has done her own heroic work on a number of fronts.
Yeah.
But this is, I'm really conflicted by this. Not because I disagree with stopping mountaintop removal, but because there are 20 young people in jeopardy right now, and no real chance of getting them out in the foreseeable future, because each one of them is under $25,000 cash bond. You know, in a lot of counties, John, they'll set bond at say $25,000, but you can get a bail bondsman to come in and you pay him $2,500. And the bondsman can stand good for the rest, pending the outcome of the, you know, case.
Yeah.
Well, they don't accept those in Lincoln County, West Virginia. It's cash or property only.
And see that's the kind of background work that I'm afraid maybe wasn't done in this case. You know, so I'm just sort of.
Well, as far as I can tell, and this is probably. And this, you know, this comes because I had a cup of coffee in law school. You know, they reinforce on the first day of 1L that old saying that the person who represents herself has a fool for a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And in situations like this where the situation itself can become fluid and change in a very, very short period of time and in ways that you cannot begin to imagine, to go into that situation without lawyers on the ground, ready to act, ready to file the necessary paperwork, whether it be some sort of ex-rel petition or whether it be habeas corpus or simply a motion for bond reduction.
Mm-hmm.
To not be ready for that is a terrible mistake. And I've made inquiries, and those lawyers are not there.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's a huge, huge problem. Because because what you have here is you have, and this is a little bit of inside baseball, so I hope you'll forgive me for going into it. But the way West Virginia's justice system works, and since we're talking about the criminal justice system, that's our lowest rung of legal process is something that we here call magistrate court. And a magistrate is an elected official who does not even, by definition, have to have a high school diploma.
Really?
Doesn't have to have a legal education. They get sent to magistrate in school by the Supreme Court of West Virginia, but there is no requirement that they apply the law properly. So in the case of each of these 20 individuals to be corrected, each of these individuals was arrested on two charges. One is simple trespass, simple criminal trespass. And it does not carry jail time at all. It carries a maximum of I think, $100 fine.
Okay.
Again, I could be wrong. The second charge is the ubiquitous obstructing an officer charge.
Oh, right. That's where the penalty comes in.
But it's still a misdemeanor. And it can only carry up to a year in the county jail, not the prison system, a year in the county jail and a fine of $1,000.
Mm-hmm.
Now, under those circumstances, for a magistrate to simply say to 20 people, all of whom have different circumstances, all of whom have different residences, all of whom have, you know, are entirely different human beings, a one-size-fits-all $25,000 bond seems, to my mind, to be nothing if not an abuse of the position.
Mm-hmm.
And again, when you've got a lawyer on the front end of all of this, you know, a judicial ethics complaint can be filed. A judicial ethics complaint should be filed against this magistrate.
Mm-hmm.
But none of that is there. You know, there's one kid there's one young man who has been alleged to have been badly injured by the authorities,
mm-hmm.
who is a West Virginia resident, and is still in jail. This is the kind of stuff that makes an activist or somebody like me who can to the whatever I am sit up nights in a cold sweat.
Yeah.
So I mean that's the reality. What they did, the act of civil disobedience, like I said, though, I want to be 100% clear, was noble and profound.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure. I'm not sure if it was the right thing to do. But of course, I wasn't in on the planning. I barely even knew about it.
Yeah. Well, what you're saying makes me more troubled, and I want to be clear too. I mean, I'm not at all really critical of the motivation behind it. I'm troubled by what's happened, and like you said, you got to think a lot about the jurisdiction where this is happening, and if a magistrate can impose these fines with no check, you know, and being in West Virginia, being in a brutal place, I'm very, very upset by how it's played out, and I just kind of wish maybe it could have gone a bit different. But I'm glad to hear your take on it. You filled in a lot of details, and I appreciate that. I hope I didn't make you talk about something that you're uncomfortable talking about.
No. I want to make sure I get it said right, because I've got a very happy inner radical. I'm very, very comfortable with the idea of confronting the power structure, by means that will comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable, as the saying goes.
Right.
But I don't know where this thing went sideways in the planning stages. But again, if you don't have a lawyer on site, on call, ready to go, then you're not ready to deal with the exigencies that come with some of this, because this is West Virginia, John. This is a state that is a wholly owned subsidiary of the coal industry. And so if the coal company tells the state government to froggy, the state government says how high. You know, the fact that, you know, that remark by Joe Manchin, that incredibly offensive remark by Joe Manchin, that a federal judge declaring that it's that an EPA rule that stopped people from being poisoned is a great day for West Virginia?
Yeah.
John, is it a great day for the 3,975 excess deaths that will happen this year? Is it a great day for the 11 people who will die before midnight tonight?
Well, it's a travesty, and I just wish that people, you know, would recognize who's really, you know, on their side. And there's just so much propaganda and so much coal money, and it's just all filthy. And that struck me and just made me very sad to see. And I don't know what to tell you.
Exactly. And so now, under the worst of circumstances, the state coffers of this entirely corrupt government gets $500,000 to play with and get the interest off of until the cases are resolved in a year. Anybody want to calculate $500,000 at 10% interest? Or five?
Yeah.
Or 2.5?
Yeah.
And I'm going to go ahead and go out on a limb and say something that may seem petty.
Okay.
At the same time that this call for a $500,000 worth of bail money to be brought forward, at the same time that's going out, you got people working in Washington, D.C. eating beans. I'm not kidding, eating beans, trying to get a piece of legislation passed.
That's not petty at all, I don't think. This is what we've been talking about so often, is that we're, you know, can we channel just a very, very, very small amount of money from people who are on our side into something productive like the work you've been doing? And it was kind of heart-wrenching for me to hear you talk about, you know, broadcasting out of the basement and eating beans, which I'm sure it was a good time.
Oh, there's some damn fine beans, John.
And the cornbread with the basil? Oh, my God, that sounded great. But the work you're doing should be supported, and it's I understand your frustration seeing that.
Well, if I'm this far out on the limb, I may as well go out until it shakes real good. You know, the Sierra Club has this thing called the Beyond Coal campaign.
Yeah.
It's $50 million.
Mm-hmm.
The 8 campaign hasn't seen a penny. And won't see a penny.
Why aren't they interested in mountaintop removal?
Oh, they want to end mountaintop removal yesterday.
Yeah. But they're not helping fund people who are doing work and making progress on the ground.
When we put this idea forward, they said, we don't really think a political effort in this year is going to yield any real results.
What year would a political effort work if not an election year?
Well, see, this is why I kick furniture, John.
Yeah, okay.
The fact of the matter is, look, I'm just going to tell it. We started asking for help back last year in the fall. By January, we had gotten a note saying, well, we don't think it's a good idea for you people to do this. But if you want to have a meeting, we can certainly have a meeting in late April.
Oh, come on.
By March the 1st, we had a commitment for the bill.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I felt so funny. From March 1st to June the 19th, saying, we're doing stuff, I just can't tell you what it is. Because
mm-hmm.
I this is all about openness and being forthright and everything, and you know, there that was. And so that was the problem. And if we had waited until April the 28th or whatever it was, then we would have had committee meetings to find out what shape the bill would take, if there was even going to be a push for a bill. And we'd have to have a committee meeting to determine the date to have another committee meeting about whether we wanted a bill. And when we had the committee meeting about whether we wanted the bill, we'd schedule another committee meeting to determine whether the bill would end mountaintop removal, some of it or all of it. You know, some people in this listening audience may have gotten an email today from an organization reminding folks that with the August recess upon us, their elected representatives would be heading home
mm-hmm.
and holding town hall meetings and offering them a toolkit for advocating for the end of mountaintop removal.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was on the road when this thing went out, but I called Agnes, and she followed it all the way, you know, she drilled all the way down through the link in the email, all the way through the toolkit, all the way to the point where there was a request for donations, and a mention of two pieces of legislation that go toward an end of at least some mountaintop removal. I've referenced those pieces of legislation in the past, and I have worked on getting co-sponsors for them.
Mm-hmm.
This organization knows full well about H.R. 5959. They know what it would do, and there was not a mention of it, John. And I won't mince words. I was profoundly offended by that. Have I shot my foot myself in the foot yet?
I don't think so, because what you're saying is reasonable, and everyone who listens to it and cares about this, you know, should be upset by it. I guess part of this is the frustration that comes with working in the system, and maybe that is the kind of thing. Well, I know that's the kind of thing that drives people to go for a more direct thing. Maybe these are connected, but you know, there's times for direct action. There's times for the kind of shoe leather work that you're doing, and they're both going to have frustrations and setbacks. You know, I'm impressed because it seems like the ache work is having an impact.
It is.
And I think that's very encouraging. And
People are getting energized because they see that this actually would bring about, if passed and signed by the president, this would bring about the end of mountaintop removal, no questions asked. The existing permits would be mined to their conclusion because we can't stop those, but there would be no new permits, and once the science is in, we are absolutely convinced that the science would be so clear that no human being of any kind of conscience whatsoever could ever support it ever happening again. And the fact of the matter is, some of this is leadership. And I am loath to take any credit, but Bo Webb is a leader. When Judy Bonds died, you know, she and Bo were the closest of friends. And Judy and I were friends and colleagues. And she was the beating heart of the effort to end mountaintop removal. And when she passed away of cancer that we're convinced was at least in part brought on by 40 years of living next to a coal prep plant or a coal mine or coal this or coal that or just living where you had to breathe the air.
Mm-hmm.
When she died, a vacuum was formed in the leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And Bo Webb stepped in to that vacuum. And Bo Webb is suffused with the idea that mountaintop removal has to end, John. And I'm not speaking for him. I'm only saying things that he said to me. It has to end. Anything that does not move in the direction of ending mountaintop removal is counterproductive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on the one hand, sometimes you have to march. But if you're marching in the wrong direction, the marching is for naught. So, and I don't mean that like a rally march or anything. I'm speaking figuratively.
Sure.
But he and I and a few others started talking about this idea, and we said, and you know, for instance, if you've read Jeff Biggers for the last 3 or 4 years, he's been talking about two things. He and Bo were the first ones to ever put out the idea of a moratorium on mountaintop removal based on human health. And then Jeff and I began talking about the idea of viewing the struggle against mountaintop removal as an abolition movement. You know, no half measures. You can't end mountaintop removal for somebody over here if it's going to happen to somebody else over there anyway.
Right.
It's got to be an abolition movement. And so that's what's been going, you know, that was what was going on in our minds when we finally looked up and said, listen, We got to do something to end it. What would do something to end it? And out of that came the process that eventually wound up being the Appalachian Community Health Emergency Act. And there was a ton of time went into it. You know, by saying that we have not had help from some groups, I do not want to make it appear that we have not had help from any. Earth Justice has been with us every step of the way, and they have done magnificent work, and they are on my list of heroes at the top. But you know they're limited too, so they've provided us tremendous logistical support, and all taken together. You know, it is an amazing piece of work that has gotten done on a budget that can only be called a shoestring.
Yeah.
We're actually the last fraying thread of a worn-out shoestring. So, I hope I probably exceeded my brief, and I know that I've gone way outside answering your original question, so I apologize for both.
No, I enjoyed hearing it, and you know this, you know, you can't put a price tag or a dollar sign on passion. And if you've got passion, I have to believe that you're gonna win out in the end, you know. And it's obvious that it's there. And may not be comfort, you know, over the umpteenth dinner of beans and cornbread, but a lot of people did a lot of good work living on that sort of thing.
Absolutely, so absolutely, and you know, we're not gonna fret that. But by the same token, yeah, everything is directed, John, by the idea that it has to end, and anything that doesn't end it is not isn't on our agenda.
Yeah.
So,
well, I'm happy to be a really small part of it, and
you're a bigger part than you know.
I appreciate you sort of talking that out with me. It's good. I'm gonna get out of your way here, but it's good to talk to you.
Thank you, John. Have a good night.
All right.
Bye
Thank
now.
You. Goodbye.
That's Dr. John. And I hope I haven't upset anybody. I hope I haven't made anybody angry. But the only thing that motivates us is the idea of ending this. And we can't just end it for some. And the other side is absolutely crazier than a sprayed roach. You know, what am I supposed to think when the junior senator from West Virginia is celebrating a court decision that means more people die? What other way is there to characterize that? And I don't want anybody walking away with the idea that I'm somehow looking down my nose on that direct action. I'm not. But when people's freedom and liberty and you know, good names are at risk, there's a lot of T's to be crossed and a lot of I's to be dotted before one of those things begins. And it just looks like they didn't get it. Now, the other side of that coin is that I freely acknowledge that an injustice is being practiced on 20 decent, upstanding, good American citizens right now. You think if I had $500,000 laying around that I wouldn't? Sure, and so would you have. I mean, if I could pick up the phone and call a lawyer and say, you know, would you pretty please? Actually, I did. Couldn't get it done. Would you pretty please go out and file a habeas and a bond reduction, so that this injustice can be cleared up? That I did. Couldn't offer any money, but that I did. But let there be no mistake, and I don't want to diminish the sacrifices of another generation, because I reverence those even more. But you know, when direct actions were held, civil disobedience was held in places like North Carolina and Alabama and Mississippi, there were no misconceptions that there was going to be anything resembling justice. And horrors were perpetrated, and people paid with their lives in the civil rights struggle. And nobody ever wanted to see that. And I don't want to see that now. And while I don't run around very often saying, I'm afraid of this or I'm afraid of that, I'm afraid, because of the way this state and this state's government and this state's dominant industry operate, I am afraid for those young people. Horribly afraid. They've been put into jail alongside real criminals. When there is nothing out there to indicate that their conduct was anything but a matter of civil disobedience. It wasn't destruction of property. It wasn't criminal brawling. It wasn't anything like that. But they're being treated as if it was. I guarantee you, I guarantee you, if I went out and surveyed bonds set by magistrates in Lincoln County in the past 2 months, I could find grand larceny, conspiracy to commit a felony. I could maybe find robbery, armed robbery, dope deals. And I bet I could find a half a dozen if I could. I bet I could find 20 where the bond for violent crime was less than the bond that was set for these young people acting out of nothing but the noblest concern. For this tormented state. And yet, there was a blog post about this, and here's what one of the friends of Cole said, referring to Ken Ward, who's author of the Cole Tattoo blog, who is the author of the Cole Tattoo blog, who had written very evenly handed about the whole process. One person said, "I think you would support the devil if he was a tree hugger." And then another individual said, "How more radical can you be by protesting something they really have no idea about?" You know what? These 20 kids probably, not kids, these 20 young people probably know more about mountaintop removal than 99% of West Virginia. How more radical can you be by protesting something they really have no idea about? They are mostly outsiders. Let's see. What were the Freedom Riders called in places like Mississippi Stan and Alabama Stan? Oh yeah, that's right. Outside agitators. They are mostly outsiders who spend a few weeks running around here, claiming to be here to save West Virginia, gather 15 minutes of fame by breaking state law, and are gone again until next year's 15 minutes. Really? If they are not mostly out-of-state paid protesters going to college, how can they come down here and spend their summer organizing? Most of us have to maintain a job 12 months out of the year. They have no solutions to bring to the table. Really? I've heard lots of solutions. If you listen to this program, every night you hear mention of the Coal River Wind Project that would have brought 400 jobs, cheap electricity, and may yet, and a tax base to Raleigh County, West Virginia that the coal industry can't even begin to touch that would be there forever. They have no solutions to bring to the table. They can't answer the hard questions about their cause, as we seen Saturday morning in a face-to-face in Kanawha State Forest. Because they were confronted, these young people, by a bunch of coal thugs. How am I going to feed my family? Am I just supposed to get on welfare? Why, what are we going to do? We just going to freeze to death in the dark? Those aren't the hard questions. Those are the same bullshit questions that they've been screaming for years. Freeze to death in the dark. Jesus Christ, I ran the Green News report a little bit earlier, and Brad and Desi talked about Germany crossing another threshold with solar and with solar power, not even factoring in wind. Really, they're just paid protesters doing someone else's dirty work. You know what? Some of these so-called paid protesters have lived through winters in West Virginia without heat. And without enough food to eat. I do know some of that reality. I know. But no, this clown just makes it up as he goes along. Why do we hold these people in higher regard than West Virginia's own tax-paying citizens? They came in here and broke our laws. They should be penalized. Okay, fine. The punishment for obstructing an officer is up to 1 year in the county jail and up to $1,000 fine. The punishment for trespass may actually go to $1,000, but I don't think there's any jail attached to it. Certainly no $25,000 worth. They are not answering a higher calling. They are lawbreakers. Jesus, what? Would this sound any different if Byron Della Beckwith was saying it? Would this sound any different if Bull Connor was saying it? Would this sound any different if George Wallace was saying it? Who the hell is this clown to suggest what kind of calling young people willing to put their own freedom at risk are answering? See, this is one of the problems of living here. I love my state, but my state has a lot of flat-out, sure-enough, no-kidding morons in it. Lawbreakers who are in a great debt to the West Virginia State Police and Boone County Sheriff's Department. That's what they are. You understand? They are not answering a higher calling. They are lawbreakers. Lawbreakers who are in a great debt to the West Virginia State Police and Boone County Sheriff's Department. You know what that means? This ass is suggesting that the Boone County Sheriff's Department and West Virginia State Police kept a bunch of pro-coal thugs from killing them. Meg Imp, who's the clown? Just a commenter on a blog. Just your average garden variety, friend of coal, dumber than dirt, ain't got sense enough to pour piss out of a boot with directions on the heel. Thug. But this guy is actually suggesting that the West Virginia State Police and the Boone County Sheriff's Department kept those coal thugs from killing these young people. That's my state. So now, probably, between now and tomorrow, I'll get an email about Bob, why don't you move? And my only, and I'm not setting a straw man up, I'm just going to tell you. Do you run from a fight? When your family is being assaulted, do you run away? Would you let yourself be run out of your home? Or would you do everything in your power to protect your home and your family and your progeny and your future? Bo Webb went home to find out that in his absence, the coal company running the mountaintop removal operation above his house has gone about half damn wild. And he ain't running away. And I don't live near as close to it as what Brother Bo does. So thank you, John, for opening that door. I do appreciate it. Because I had no idea of how to talk about this and be in the way that it deserved, and you made it possible. You made it possible, John. I really do appreciate that. Because the story does need to go out. People do need to understand that West Virginia, as I've argued time and time again, is not fully an American state. If you're willing to sacrifice 3,975 excess deaths per year, you cannot in the same breath argue that the people being sacrificed are a part of we the people. Can you? And understand again, I recognize that other people are being tormented. I saw people who had been tormented from all over the United States on Saturday afternoon. People who cannot get a drink of water. And that's part of the larger purpose of the AIC Act. To show what can be done with this peer-reviewed science. To show what kind of a petition for redress of grievances can be put before the government. And the hope that if we can win this struggle, that others can too. This August, there is a massive amount of action taking place in the American West, all the way from the Powder River Basin of Wyoming, all the way through Montana, places like Missoula. I can't be there. Maybe Kate can go and stand in as my surrogate. Or just say howdy. And all the way over to places like Bellingham, Washington, where they're trying to stop a whole bunch of coal terminals before the damned filthy things can get started. Because this has to be understood to be a global struggle. How many people lost power for 2 days in a row because of India's ancient, antiquated, filthy, dirty, rotten old coal-fired power system? You can follow the past or follow the future. I've looked at the globe. Doesn't the sun shine a whole lot in India? Wouldn't an Indian government that actually cared about its people put everything, heart and soul, into solarizing a very warm place? Why does India need coal-fired electric power when the sun shines there practically every day? And when the sun isn't shining, odds are the wind is blowing. There is a decent and good future available to the people of Earth. To my brothers and sisters in India and Bangladesh, tormented by the coal industry for every last scrap in the ground. To my brothers and sisters tree-sitting in a forest in Germany, trying to protect the forest and the communities surrounding an open pit strip mine. My brothers and sisters in Colombia. My brothers and sisters in Alaska, where a coal company still wants to replace 17 miles of ancient salmon reproducing breeding stream with a concrete ditch to get at wet carboniferous mud that's actually under sea level so it can be shipped to China. And my brothers and sisters in China who breathe that filth and work like slaves in it. And my brothers and sisters in Australia, fighting fracking and fighting coal, struggling against coal, struggling against fracking. You know, it was a profound thing that I heard on Saturday when an Australian activist came to the microphone and bid us g'day. And said, you know, one of the problems with America is that everything you do winds up here. And so he said, just as you developed your fracking technology here and you're trying to destroy every last drop of drinkable water you've got on the North American continent, well, dadgum, if the same technology hasn't been exported to Australia and they're starting to frack there. Now, if I understand my Australian geography correctly, and if I'm mischaracterizing it, I will be corrected, I know. There's places in Australia that just don't have a shitload of water. There's places there that ain't hardly got none at all. There's places that are awfully lush and beautiful. But water is understood there, isn't it, John Fox, to be a scarce natural resource and precious natural resource. But somewhere there is a profit-driven, avaricious, sociopathic hydrocarbon company that doesn't care. Doesn't care. It is a global struggle. And we must always be mindful of that. And I am so glad. I'm so grateful. And yes, I'm so proud to know that you share that understanding. Yeah, okay, thank you, John Fox. 70% of New South Wales has been put up for license. All our water, says John Fox, comes from the Great Artesian Basin. All of that is under threat. Flammable water already found in Queensland. The threat is global. And the number of people perpetrating that threat is tiny, but they have vast amounts of money, and they do not care what happens to the rest of us. And the only hope we have against those predatory bastards is that we all stand shoulder to shoulder, that we all link arms, and we all say no. So I guess it's time to round out tonight's Titanic Tuesday. Damn it, I didn't mean to filibobster like that. Especially not on a day when I've driven home. Sorry about that. Robert in Australia. And they're fracking in the wine-growing district? What the... And they are. And they are. There's no... They'd frack your house. They'd frack your mother if they thought there was a dollar in it. We must understand the predatory nature of these sociopaths. And they really are. Uh-oh. I better stop. Thanks, everybody. I can tell you that as we speak, we are $35 from meeting Sal's challenge. So thanks to y'all who have helped to meet it. $35, just $35 away from meeting Sal's Titanic Tuesday challenge. PayPal buttons at headonradionetwork.com. And thanks for all that all of you do. We will be back. You know what tomorrow is, right? Prayer meeting Wednesday. Somebody, one of these days we're going to replace them buttermints in the vestibule. I hope you'll join us. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this happen. Thanks to each and every one of you whose contributions keep this going and have kept us going. In this every month, but also especially in this incredibly brutal month of July, we get to say goodbye to it at midnight, and what a joyful adieu it will be. Thank you for your time, for your ideas, your contributions of thoughts and passion, compassion, anger, fury, intellect, everything that makes a conversation on the horn so incredibly special. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky in the chat room. Thanks go out to our buddy Randy, who has provided us with a new uninterruptible power supply that will hopefully remedy some of these ongoing problems that happen when the power even blinks. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thanks to our blogger, Texas Betsy. Welcome back to Austin, Betsy. It sure was fun on Saturday. Thank you to John Fox for all he does and continues to do. Thanks to Ben Birch at WhiteRoseSociety.org. Not a blessed thing comes out of your speakers in the way of the horn that doesn't come through the good offices of Ben Birch at WhiteRoseSociety.org. And thanks, of course, to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, ACACT.org. Go there. Learn how you can be a part of ending Appalachia's agony. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you. Rick Smith is next, only on the Horn.
With America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! You let her produce for a week and she won't leave the studio when you come back. Honest to God, I'm not kidding. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. I'm not kidding. Agnes is standing here, and I'm getting ready to do the show like I've been doing for the last 5 years, you know, after Agnes went back to be mom instead of producer. And she's pointing at buttons, making sure I do it right. Betsy's in the chat room. She says, hi, Agnes.
Hi, Betsy.
So, now I'm back from Washington, D.C., and all kinds of things are going sideways. We lost the connection to the... We were a little late starting the program because we lost the connection to the server. Internet went down. Power flashed. There is a thunderstorm rolling over top of the mansion now, even as I speak. Power's gone out a couple of times. What, dear? Is it buffering? Did you see it buffer? Okay. Yeah, see, we're buffering and stuff. Smack your hand next time you do that.
Is the computer working way better, Bob?
Computer is working way better.
Thank you, John.
Yes, thank you, John. Thank you, Agnes. But this is where we find ourselves on this Titanic Tuesday. It's Titanic Tuesday now. Like I said, I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn. Head on RadioNetwork.com. America's liberal voice, your home for what we like to call conversation radio. And I have literally just walked in the door not too many minutes ago from Washington, D.C. We beat a hot path back from the nation's capital, from the headquarters of the AIC campaign, the Appalachian Community Health Emergency Campaign, our signature work being the AIC Act, the Appalachian Community Health Emergency Act, H.R. 5959. That you can be a part of, and you can do the biggest part of the work. If you were listening to last night's show, you got an idea of what it means to go out there and advocate for the AIC Act, as you have in hearing from other folks who've emailed in and to let us know what they were doing. We're back. We're back.
That's why I have to show Bob what buttons to press, because he's back.
Isn't she sweet? And there's nothing condescending in that. It's the truth. I've been away from my beloved wife for 9 days now. Well, today was the ninth day. But I'm just glad to be back. For all the sideways craziness that goes on around here, I'm just happy to be home. Because as Dorothy knew, as Dorothy noted, there's no place like home. There's no place like home. There's no place like home.
Click your heels, Bob.
Even if the soil is full of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbon toxins, even if the water is full of heavy metals, there's no place like home. And that's what makes Appalachia worth fighting for. This is The Horn, available on the Internet only, except in a couple of locations where yar, pirate radio stations are operating and beaming us out into the ether. You can get The Horn in a variety of fashions. You can get it most easily head on RadioNetwork.com and the one-click player button. You can get it via the stream at WhiteRoseSociety.org. You can get it at iTunes Radio. You can get it at Stitcher Radio. You can get it at Tuner Internet Radio and TuneIn Radio and probably a variety of other platforms, as I've noted, that I'm not aware of. But if you're listening some other way, do please let me know. We're listener-supported. We are trying to find our way to the merciful end of what has been a very long July. Sweet Jesus, it has been a long July. It all began with the derecho that struck on June the 29th, and it looks like we're going to go out on some sort of nasty thunderstorm. Hopefully it won't take out the studio and won't take out the phones and won't take out tonight's program. No, hopefully we will get through tonight's Titanic Tuesday program. Just a reminder, Titanic Tuesday is named after the right wing. It follows on the heels of Moran Monday, and it's named after a Moran over in Beckley, West Virginia, who informed his Moran right wing listeners that in fact fossilized impressions of shellfish exist in rock strata of West Virginia because of the movement of the Titanic plates beneath the earth. Yes. And thus, Titanic Tuesday brought to us, or we were informed of Titanic, the Titanic plates by our dear old buddy Jim. This has become Titanic Tuesday. And so, I guess, I don't know, maybe it's sort of an addendum to Moran Monday. And I don't know if this, I don't know exactly how this fits, but it seems the appropriate place to start. A tale of two judges, if you will. A tale of two Bush appointees to the bench. On the one hand, U.S. District Judge Vanessa L. Bryant, who sits on the second in Second Circuit as District Judge.